Minister for Health, Leo Varadkar, is here. Good morning, Minister.
Morning.
We'll talk health in a moment, but first you were listening to Patrick Honohan there. What do you think? How will these new rules help stop another property bubble?
Well, I suppose to understand this, you have to back up a little and recall that 7 years ago our economy crashed, and at the root of that crash was a housing and construction bubble, which was very much fueled by credit, reckless borrowing and reckless lending. And it's really only now, because of the enormous sacrifices that people have made, that our economy is now recovering. You know, there's 80,000 people back at work. House prices are rising again. There's more money in people's payslips this month. But the recovery isn't secure yet. It is fragile. And there are threats to that recovery. And among those threats are things like political instability here or abroad, but also the potential return of a credit bubble or a property bubble. And the measures that the central bank have put in place are designed to avoid that.
Do you think they'll work?
I think they will. I don't think they'll work on their own. Obviously, one of the things that is necessary to make sure we don't have house prices spiking again in the cities in particular is an increase in supply. We do need to start building many more houses again. But I do think this makes sense. And if you go back 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, it wasn't unusual for people to have to have a substantial deposit before they bought a house, and banks were restricted in how much they could lend in terms of the multiple of your income. So I think this is sensible, it's prudential. It's not just about protecting the banks, it's also about protecting the public from another credit-fueled property bubble, which is in nobody's interest.
In May, the Taoiseach said he was very sorry that thousands of sick people had their medical cards removed. This was after your party lost several seats at the local elections, and he promised to fix the system. Now, you promised to make it more sensitive, you said in November, but still award cards based on financial means and not illness. You're appointing a clinical advisory group today. What will they do that the expert panel that was there before them didn't or couldn't do?
Yeah, well, I should say that this is all still very much a work in progress, and I do very much welcome the feedback from the various different advocacy groups, whether it's Age Action or Jack and Jill or other groups like that. What's happened so far is that where a medical card is awarded on the basis of a terminal illness, it's no longer reviewed. We don't do routine reviews of discretionary medical cards, and there is now broader and wider discretion. Even when somebody is over the income limit, if they have significant medical expenses, they can qualify for a medical card. And the proof of that is in the numbers. The number of discretionary medical cards in circulation has gone up from about 50,000 this time last year to 75,000 now. And when you include discretionary doctor visit cards, there's 108,000 now, which is higher than there was when this government came to office. So, you know, the situation is improving. It is far from perfect yet. And the next step in those reforms is the appointment this week of the clinical advisory group. And what they're going to do, which the expert group didn't do, is draw up a set of guidelines around which officials and medical officers who are processing medical card applications can disregard the means test, if you like, yeah, and say that because the burden of illness is so great on an individual or a family, they can still get a medical card even when their income is above the means test.
A work in progress. Why is this all taking so long, by the way? I mean, your government were told about these problems last January. The Taoiseach finally admitted there was a problem in May, and you said in November that this advisory group was being established. It takes another 3 months to appoint it, another 3 months to report. Are you kicking to touch here?
No, definitely not. And if we were, we wouldn't have had that 50% increase in the number of discretionary cards
This group is going to sit for 2 years. Why?
Well, that's not quite the case. What they will do is they'll be established this week, and quite frankly, it's been difficult to get people to agree.
Why?
To sit on it, because it's a very complicated area, trying to come up with a set of guidelines to assess how unwell and what burden of illness somebody is suffering from. But what's going to happen is they'll have 3 months to draw up the revised guidelines for discretionary cards, but they will stay in place for 2 years, because we're never going to assume that we get this exactly right, and medicine changes and circumstances change. And what we want to have them there is to keep reviewing the guidelines on you know, as things develop, but also if there's a doubt, if there's a very difficult case, the official in the HSC or the medical officer can then go to that group for advice. So that's why they're there for.
You mentioned
this to be a standing
cases.
Committee, essentially.
I don't want to highlight individual cases, but there are lots of them, and you'll be aware of some of them. Very ill children with very worried parents, in all their cases, being made as they would see it, to jump through hoops to get to a medical card, while you and your government want to persist with giving free GP care eventually to all children, healthy, wealthy or otherwise, just because they're under six. How is that fair?
Well, obviously I can't comment on individual cases. You know, I don't have any application forms on my desk,
yes,
and I don't have access to families' financial
but
information.
But the principle of sick children being made to jump through hoops to get cards, with healthy children under the age of six being awarded them on the basis of age.
Yeah, the situation is as this, and I've looked at this in so many different ways, so many different times, is that until we have universal healthcare in Ireland, until everyone is entitled to healthcare, regardless of their income, there are always going to be people who are just above a threshold, whether it's an income threshold or a threshold based on medical hardship. So what we need to do is phase in, over time, a system of universal healthcare. The first step to that is access to a GP without fees for everyone over 70 and everyone under 6. It's not just happening on its own. It's part of a number of things that are happening, and this is the first phase. And bear in mind, particularly when it comes to the under 6s, it's not just extending the doctor visit card to, we'll say, the children of middle class and better off parents. It's a whole new primary care service for all children under 6, which will include things like public health surveillance.
If you have a sick child over the age of 6, can you understand why the system seems deeply unfair?
Yeah, of course I can, and that's why we've widened discretion already, and that's why we're appointing the clinical advisory group to widen it further to take into account medical hardship and the burden of an illness on an individual or their family, regardless of their income.
A new pay structure for new hospital consultants you're also announcing. This is off the back, of course, of the ballot where the IMO have agreed to this. Why will this attract more doctors to apply to fill vacant posts, in your view? Because they're going to be paid more?
Yeah, in part. You know, first of all, when we talk about health, it does tend to focus on the things that are going wrong or the various controversies, and there are a lot of them, but there are some good things happening in health. Yesterday, we had two items of good news. The first was that VHI was freezing its premiums and reducing some premiums, and that follows on from the fact that Leia made a decision as well earlier on to reduce some of its premiums and freeze others. And that's important because one of our objectives is to make health insurance more affordable for people and to increase the number of people who have insurance cover. Again, that's part of the move towards universal insurance. The other good news yesterday
is
was
that you're going to pay new hospital consultants more money. Is that what's required to attract more of them to apply for jobs, yes?
It is, yeah. The reality is that, roughly speaking, there are 250 vacant consultant posts around the country, and as a result of that, in hospitals there aren't enough senior decision makers, so, you know, patients aren't getting the standard of care that they should be getting, and in some cases are being admitted unnecessarily, and also in some cases we can't get waiting lists down because there are no consultants to see the patients. So this does mean the partial restoration of pay for consultants. It's nothing like what they were paid 5 or 6 years
and
ago, by the way.
Nothing like what many of them can earn when they're doing private work. If you're going to pay them more to do public work, will you make sure that those who are hired to do the job do what they're paid to do? If they're hired to do 37 or 39 hours public service a month, how are you going to make sure they do that?
Yeah, there are different pay scales depending on whether you're a consultant who works only in the public sector or whether you're allowed to do private work as well. And essentially what's in place are medical manpower managers. And this is why you do need managers in the health service, by the way, to make sure that consultants honour the terms and conditions
and
of their
contract. And if
they don't? Well, if they don't, then that's a breach of contract and requires disciplinary action.
Have you had to do that yet?
I haven't personally come across it, but it is the role, obviously, both of clinical directors, who are senior doctors within the hospital, and the medical manpower managers to make sure that consultants honour their contracts. But what I do know for a fact is that the vast majority of consultants, maybe 70-80%, not only do the hours they're paid to do, but actually do extra hours. And I think it's important to point out that any consultants who are not honouring the terms of their contracts are very much in the minority.
I'll get to Brian Jennings with news headlines in a moment. If you're watching on RT News Now, you'll see that he has come into our studio. Just two other matters I wanted to get to, Minister, before we go. As former Transport Minister, do you believe it's in the country's best interest to sell Aer Lingus?
Well, look, we're in an offer period at the moment, so I'm limited in what I can say. The government's position is that any offer, of course, has to be considered. It's not just about money, it's not just about the value of the 25% stake. We're also going to take into account other things, as we did in the past, during previous offers when I was minister, issues like competition, issues like connectivity, which is so important for all of our airports.
If they're that important, jobs. Should we keep our stake?
Well, that's something obviously the government has to.
What do you think?
I'm not at liberty to have that conversation here, unfortunately. That's something that I can only have around the cabinet table.
Front page of the Irish Examiner this morning, TD defends Higgins abusers. This is Michael D. Higgins, the president, who, according to the Examiner, was being verbally abused by demonstrators in Dublin yesterday. Anti-Austerity Alliance Deputy Paul Murphy insisted the president was a legitimate focus for campaigners to demonstrate against, as he had signed the water charge bill into law without referring it for review. What do you think?
Well, I suppose what strikes me is that as the water protesters get fewer, they're getting nastier. And what we have here is something that I've never seen before. Under our constitution, the president is above day-to-day politics. If a bill is constitutional, he has to sign it. It's not his choice as to whether he signs it or not. And to see him targeted in this way, I think, is an attack on our constitution. And even the kind of language used against him really is beneath common decency.
Minister for Health, Leo Varadkar, thank you for coming in this morning. 8:33.